Welcome to the local brown bagger on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Today we have a real treat for you, Paul Watson, and he's out there in the South Pacific right now chasing off the whalers.
I was debating a whaler in Norway one time, and he says, "But Watson, you know, you're incredibly stupid. You think that whales are more intelligent than people. How can you say such a stupid, stupid thing?" I said, "Well, George, you know, I happen to measure intelligence by the ability to live in harmony with the natural world, and by that criteria, whales are far more intelligent than we are." He said, "By that criteria, cockroaches are more intelligent than us." I said, "George, you're beginning to understand what I'm trying to say."
That's Paul Watson, and this is the third season of Canadian Voices, a nationally syndicated radio series and podcast featuring lectures by thought-provoking Canadians. The program is offered free of charge to campus and community radio stations across Canada and is available online at canadianvoices.org. The series is produced by Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm Zoe Creighton. They fire chocolate pies and stink bombs from cannons. They also sink docked ships. They've dismantled the illegal Icelandic whaling industry and have been attacked by the Norwegian Navy. Governments and the corporate media call them eco-terrorists, but these activists call themselves the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Their sole mission is to defend marine wildlife. The group's founder, Paul Watson, has been denounced by many as a misanthrope. He's been arrested in Canada, Norway, and Holland for his direct actions against the fishing and hunting of maritime animals. The Sea Shepherds draw a clear line between property destruction and physical violence, and there are few that would argue against their commitment to enforcing international environmental laws, yet their methods put them at the center of much controversy. A run-in with the group may be very costly, as when they sank half the Spanish whaling fleet, but they've never been convicted of a crime. Paul Watson defends his actions as falling within international law and defends Sea Shepherd's right to enforce maritime regulations against illegal whalers and sealers. He spoke on the topic of saving our oceans on September 15, 2005, in Edmonton, Alberta.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back in Edmonton. I haven't been here really for 15 years, which is some time. Almost didn't make it here. When Canada found out I was going to be doing a speaking tour of the country, they put a all-Canada warrant out for my arrest. And it was rather surprising. They charged me with one of the most ridiculous things I've ever been charged with. It's a summary charge, maximum fine, $1,000. You don't put out all-Canada arrest warrants on minor charges unless you're motivated by the government to do so. Let me tell you what they want to arrest me for. I broke a Department of Transport regulation by being the captain of my own ship, and although I'm a Canadian citizen, I'm not a Canadian resident. According to DOT, I must be a Canadian resident. Now, the problem is, my ship flies a Canadian flag, but it's a non-revenue paying vessel, meaning that I didn't pay duty on it, which means I have to stay out of Canada most of the year, and I'm allowed in at the maximum of 3 weeks. Revenue Canada regulations state I cannot have a Canadian resident as captain. Therefore, if I abide by Canadian Revenue Canada regulations, I'm in violation of DOT regulations. And if I abide by DOT regulations, I'm in violation of Revenue Canada regulations. That's the insanity of the bureaucracy in this country right now. And, of course, we're having to deal with many levels of government right now, Department of Transport, Department of Fisheries, Department of Justice. But I can tell you right now from all of my experience working in countries around the world, and we work in a lot of so-called third world countries trying to protect fisheries and endangered species and habitats in those countries, of all of my experience in all of those countries in Central, South America, Africa, Asia, I have never come across a government bureaucracy more incompetent and more mismanaged than the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans. There are more employees of DFO in the Maritimes than there are people fishing. That's how absurd it's gotten. And because of their incompetence and their mismanagement, they have to come up with a scapegoat. And their scapegoat, why did the cod disappear? The harp seal. The seal's eating all those fish. Now, if we just kill off those seals, the cod will come back. Well, when I said that it was irreparably damaged, what I meant is that that niche that the cod filled is being filled by other fish. The cod will not be returning, not in our lifetime, maybe not for millennium. They've done that much damage. Certainly isn't the harp seal, because I want to consider one thing. 1500s, early 1500s, Jacques Cartier came to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. He reported that he could throw a wicker basket into the Gulf and come up brimming with codfish. You know how many seals there were back then? 40 million. Harp seals, hood seals, harbor seals, gray seals, and walrus. The walrus is now extinct on the East Coast. There's also the sea mink, also extinct. And the giant auk and the Labrador duck, also extinct. Incredible hordes of birds and pilot whales and dolphins. It was just unbelievable the amount of life that was on the East Coast when Cartier landed. And now with the cod reduced to 4% and the seals down to, according to the government, 6 million, as far as I'm concerned, 2.5 million, they blame the seals. The government sees it two ways. They see three boxes up on their little screen there. They see people, fish, and seals. That's all they see. Simplified food chart or a simplified food chain of the Northwest Atlantic will show you that there's over 800 species in interrelationships with each other. And we keep meddling with those interrelationships, and that's why we're in so much trouble. Harp seals eat fish, but they happen to eat the fish which prey upon young cod. So when you lower harp seal populations, you increase those predatory fish populations, causing an even further decline. The government knows this. But the government for many years has hired a team of what I call DFO scientists, which I call biostitutes. Basically, here's the political objective. You find us the science to advance this objective. And it's interesting that when you put independent scientists, they come up with a position completely opposite of what the federal scientists do. And, of course, this is true all over the world. So-called equivalent fisheries departments do the same thing. They have these teams of scientists to justify what they're doing. Well, we've seen by now that they don't know what they're doing. They've been wrong consistently. They said that the cod was not in trouble until the very day it crashed. I was debating a fisheries scientists a few years ago, 1995 actually, in Vancouver. And I said, look, in 3 years, the coho population is going to crash in this area. He said, Watson, you don't have any idea what you're talking about. We have the best scientists in the world, the best computer models. And I can tell you, sir, you are wrong. And I was wrong. It crashed the next year. I set up the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society back in 1977. I left Greenpeace, and the reason being is that I was tired of protesting. I didn't want to protest. I wanted to intervene, and that's what we are. We're an interventionist organization. We get called a lot of names. Quite frankly, I really don't give a damn. You know, I'm not too concerned about what people think about us. People are not our clients. We represent our clients. They range from plankton to whales. And that's what we work for and on behalf. But I set it up as an interventionist organization. Like I said, we get called lots of names, militants, eco-terrorists, pirates. I don't have any problem with that because I know what we are. We've been arrested many times, not convicted. Why? Because all we're doing is upholding the law. There are plenty of international rules and regulations and treaties protecting the world's oceans. The problem is there's a lack of political will to enforce those regulations. We simply take it upon ourselves to enforce them. And we're empowered to do so by virtue of the United Nations World Charter for Nature that states that any individual or non-government organization is empowered to uphold international conservation law. You are empowered to uphold international conservation law. And so we use that as a defense. And as an example, in 1993, I drove the Cuban and Spanish drag trawlers off of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland, off the tail and the nose of the banks. Something that everybody seemed to want until we did it, and then the government came down on us like a ton of bricks and spent $3.5 million to arrest me out there, bring me in and put me on trial for 4 weeks with 47 government witnesses against me in a Newfoundland court where they knew they had the advantage because I'm not exactly that popular in Newfoundland. And I was the only witness for the defense. But I got the best lawyer in St. John's, who's now in Halifax, Brian Casey, biggest gun in town, and, oh, he was an artist. He walked up to the jury and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm not going to tell you we didn't do what we're charged with. I'm going to tell you we did exactly what we were charged with. We're proud to have done what we did and we intend to do it again." That was our opening defense. And I was acquitted. My defense was the UN World Charter for Nature, set a precedent in the Canadian courts. The Canadian government brought in a professor from the University of Toronto, a law professor, to argue that the UN World Charter for Nature had no authority in Canadian law. And the judge interrupted her and says, "Did Canada sign this?" And she says, "Well, yes." "Then how come it has no authority?" "Well, you know, Canada signs a lot of international agreements that we don't actually understand." So he said, "Well, if Canada signed it, I'm going to have to advise the jury to take it under consideration." My lawyer also, compared what I did to what Mr. Tobin did 2 years after. And the judge surprised us by saying, "I'm not going to allow that comparison in my courtroom." Now, we thought it was because he was the Minister of Fisheries. He said, "You know, in a criminal case, you do not compare your client's activities to that of another criminal activity. What Mr. Tobin did wasn't proper or illegal, therefore I will not allow that comparison." When my lawyer said, "Well, how come Mr. Tobin wasn't charged?" He says, "That's a matter for the Attorney General, not for me to decide." But I was acquitted on what was called color of right, that I did what I thought was proper and lawful. And we continue to oppose the trawlers. Just 3 months ago, I dropped 16 aquatic caltraps on the tail of the banks. These are big, long devices with arms. They look sort of like anti-tank devices you see in the movie The Longest Day on the beaches of Normandy, but with 18 blades on each one. And what they do is lie on the bottom of the banks, and when the drag trawls come over, they're ensnared and they rip the nets open. I told Brian Tobin many years ago, I said that, you know, you could stop all drag trawling easily by deploying 10,000 of these things out here, and it would also provide shelter for the fish. Mr. Tobin said, "Paul, we can't do that. If we did that, how do you expect the Canadian dragger fleet to return when the cod come back?" Well, I said, "Your Canadian dragger fleets are what removed the cod in the first place. You know, don't you ever learn?" Actually, it was an interesting debate with him and me on CTV. I said, "Hey, Brian, you know, as one pirate to another, what's the difference between what you did and what I did?" He says, "Paul, I had the authority of the United Nations behind me and you did not." I said, "Well, how did the Parliament of Canada behind me and you did not." And I said, "How did the Parliament of Canada give you authority outside the 200-mile limit?" And he says, "Paul, we're talking about saving a fish here, and sometimes you have to be ahead of the law to make a difference." I said, "Brian, I was 2 years ahead of you being ahead of the law." So it's really been amusing dealing with these authorities. This year, we went back to the seal hunt. 11 of my crew were arrested for breaking the regulations prohibiting the witnessing of a seal kill. In Canada, if you don't have a permit, you cannot witness, document, or film a seal being killed. Now, we all applied for the permits. My entire crew and I applied for the permits, and we were told we could get the permits, but on one condition. I had to bring my ship into the Magdalen Islands to get it, the one place the government knew I couldn't go, because they were threatening to murder us if we stepped off the ship at that dock. I said, "I can pick them up in Charlottetown." They said, "No, this is where you pick them up." I said, "What are you trying to do? Encourage acts of violence here? You know they will attack us." And I was beaten quite severely there back in 1995. He said, "That's the condition. You want your permits, you come here and get them." What happened is that our crew were arrested and they were assaulted on the ice, as you saw. I had ordered my crew, "Do not defend yourself, because if you lift one finger against those sealers, you will be charged with assault." So they couldn't defend themselves. They were hit with clubs, they were punched, they were kicked. And the Mounties very enthusiastically wanted to charge them and said, "We need the video evidence. Can you supply it?" And we did, only to find that that video evidence is now being used as evidence against us for the charges that were brought against us. That was how they got it from us. And as for charging the sealers, no charges. Last week, they said there will not be any charges. The reason being, Our presence on the ice provoked their violence. This is what it's come down to. The victim is now responsible for being assaulted. What Canada is in fact doing is giving a green light to the sealers that next year and the year after, they can escalate their violence. They're going to kill somebody, and it will be the fault of the government of Canada. It wasn't just us. The International Fund for Animal Welfare had a crew on the ice that were assaulted. Sealers were not charged. The Humane Society of the United States had a crew that were also assaulted and punched and kicked. Sealers were also not charged. The government is totally biased in this respect. In fact, the Canadian Association of Veterinarians just released a report saying that it's not proper to have DFO officers managing and regulating the seal hunt because they're all friends of the sealers, and they also said it's impossible to regulate and support the hunt at the same time. How many sealers have been arrested for cruelty on the ice? Zero. In over 30 years, zero arrests. Why? No acts of cruelty have ever taken place, according to the Ministry of Fisheries. All seals are killed with one blow to the head. Well, you saw that video. It certainly isn't true. But again, bureaucrats don't go to the ice. They stay in Ottawa and they listen to what they're told. There used to be a lot of pilot whales off the east coast of Newfoundland. They were killed by the thousands every year to provide cheap food for mink farms in Newfoundland. And the Canadian Department of Fisheries said there was no problem. They were sustainable. And then in 1966, they just disappeared, didn't come back. All the predictions of those scientists that they were sustainable were in fact not true. I don't like that word sustainable, and I don't use it because it's just a catchphrase as business as usual. If you want to greenwash your enterprise, you just say it's sustainable. There's no such thing as a sustainable fishery anymore anywhere in the world. The reason being, not enough fish, too many people. There's simply not enough fish in the world's oceans to continue to feed the ever-expanding populations of humanity, and that is a fact. We're running out of fish. And let's look at it for what it is. Fish are bushmeat. That's what they are. We condemn Africans for going into the jungle and killing chimpanzees and giraffes to eat. You know, their excuse is they need to eat. What we're doing is going into the wilderness and killing large predatory animals and bringing them back to eat. Sharks, swordfish, tuna. These are large wild animals in the wild. And we're wiping them out en masse. And as we diminish their numbers, we invest more and more money into more and more expensive technology in order to extract what is left, causing us to borrow more and more money from the banks in order to get that technology. It's a vicious circle because we have to catch more fish to pay back the banks. So the problem is that we're simply not going to solve that problem if we continue to support fisheries. You know, we hear about all this work, where conservationists are putting poor people out of work. You know, the media isn't really not concerned about people being put out of work unless it's in the interest of industry to be concerned. You know, we heard all this talk a few years ago. 50,000 loggers are going to lose their jobs because of the spotted owl. How can that be justified? 50,000 jobs because of a bird. Well, you know, the same period of time, 200,000 workers were laid off by McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, AT&T, and IBM, and nobody said a word. There was no editorials in the newspapers about those jobs because they lost their jobs for reasons we understand, the interests of the shareholders of those companies. The media doesn't care about you losing your job. They only use people's jobs as a way of justifying their defense of the corporations. That's what it's all about. There is no free press anymore in North America. It's all owned lock, stock, and barrel by the same people who are part of the problem. When people say, do you want to donate to the Hurricane Relief Fund? I said, no, I don't got to, Shell should donate. The problem is, you know, the Sierra Club, of which I'm a national director in the United States, just donated $40,000 to the hurricane relief, and I was incensed. I said, 99 cents on every charitable dollar in North America goes to human causes. 99 cents. We got a penny left to deal with ecosystems and wildlife. Let us keep the penny. These greedy bastards want our penny now. People cause the problems, and they're taking with them hundreds and hundreds, thousands of species all the time without any regard as to what the consequences are. No species can survive on this planet and ignore the basic laws of ecology. History, natural history, has demonstrated this for millions of years. Of course, for anybody who believes the world's only 5,000 years, it doesn't mean anything. But it's demonstrated this for millions of years. If you do not abide by the three basic laws of ecology, your days are numbered. The first is the law of diversity, that the strength of an ecosystem depends upon diversity within it. The second is the law of interdependence, that all those species are interdependent. And the third is the law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth. What we are doing is literally stealing the carrying capacity of other species. For our numbers to increase, they have to be removed from the earth. We're stealing their carrying capacity. But we're going to reach a point where we take too much and we're going to crash, because we're really living in a spaceship, and it's quite literally moving through the universe like a spaceship. And if I were to go into the engine room of my ship and I saw my engineers popping rivets out of the hull, and I said, "What are you doing?" "So we get a dollar apiece when we get back to port for these things, you know." I said, "Oh, really?" If I was an irresponsible captain, as most presidents and prime ministers are today, I said, "Really, huh? Well, cut me in for that." But if I was responsible, of course, I'd kick him out of the engine room and save the ship, because every species on the planet is simply a rivet in the hull of the biosphere. And we're going to remove one rivet too many, one species too many, and the biosphere is going to collapse. We don't know when that is. We're just too stupid to know. I mean, we pride ourselves in being incredibly intelligent, but when it comes to the natural world, we don't know anything about anything. You know, we pride ourselves on being the most intelligent, most highly advanced species on the planet. Why? Because we decided we are. You know, there's a lot of other species dispute this, but we don't talk to them, so we never get their point of view. I was debating a whaler in Norway one time, and he says, "But Watson, you know, you're incredibly stupid. You think that whales are more intelligent than people. How can you say such a stupid, stupid thing?" I said, "Well, George, you know, I happen to measure intelligence by the ability to live in harmony with the natural world, and by that criteria, whales are far more intelligent than we are." He said, "By that criteria, cockroaches are more intelligent than us." I said, "George, you're beginning to understand what I'm trying to say." I mean, let's face it, what are we? We're a bunch of overly self-glorified, conceited, naked apes who are divine legends in our own mind. We've created that. We've created all these fantasies and that we live with. We don't like the earth, so we've decided to create reality in other places, in other dimensions. Heaven, hell, whatever you call it. But it really dictates what our values are. Imagine for a moment going into Mecca. Walk up to that black stone and spit on it. Ooh, your chances of walking out of that city alive are somewhat remote. You're going to be ripped to pieces. Nobody will have much sympathy for you because you attacked something which was sacred to a group of people. Or walk into the city of Jerusalem, pickaxe on your shoulder. Walk up to that wailing wall and start hacking away. See how far you get. Not very far. You're going to get an Israeli's bullet, soldier's bullet in the back, and nobody's going to have much sympathy for what you did. You desecrated a sacred symbol. Walk into the Vatican and attack the Pietà with a hammer, or rip the Pope's picture up on television, see how popular it'd be. You know, you're attacking something which is sacred. Yet each and every day we go into the most profoundly mysterious and beautiful cathedrals of the natural world, the rainforests of Amazonia, the redwood forests of California, the temperate rainforests of Vancouver Island, and we totally desecrate and destroy them with bulldozers and chainsaws. And how do we react to that? Few people write some letters or dress up in animal costumes and jump up and down, and that's about it. If those forests were as sacred to us, as of value to us, if we revered them as much as a chunk of old nickel meteorite in Mecca, a decrepit old wall in Jerusalem, or a hunk of marble in the Vatican, we would simply rise up and rip those loggers limb from limb for the act of blasphemy which they're doing. But we don't do that because we're alienated from the natural world. It's not a part of us. We're all living in pie-in-the-sky fantasies. We've decided that we are demigods, different and better than everything else. You know, I get accused all the time of being anti-people, and it's probably true. I'm not very fond of people, but I'm not fond of them equally. So I can't be called a racist. I dislike everybody equally. But it's based on many years of observation of what people do to the rest of our fellow citizens on this planet. Rush Limbaugh said that you know, I would rather kill a baby than save I'd rather save a species of bacteria than to save a baby's life. And what he was referring to is the class I give at UCLA. I give my students a choice: to save the life of a human being and to make it easy, a nice, cute little baby, or to preserve a species of unknown bacteria. Does the species survive and the human die, or does the human's life get spared and the species go extinct? In an anthropocentric society, 9 out of 10 people will certainly say the human life is more important than this germ, whatever it is. In fact, one reporter in California said, all the redwoods in California aren't worth the life of one human being. So I said, how can we kill so many loggers to cut them down? But the fact is if you've chosen the baby's life over that of the unknown species of bacteria, and then I reveal to you that that's the microflora that lives in your gut that makes it possible to digest your food, thus illustrating the law of interdependence, your choice of the one human life has condemned our entire species to extinction. And that is a way of illustrating. But, of course, all Rush Limbaugh heard was that I didn't like babies. He also calls me a doom and gloom Cassandra, which illustrates to me that he didn't read classical literature, certainly not the Iliad, because if he had have, he would have realized that, yes, Cassandra did preach doom and gloom, but you know what? She was right. Everything she predicted came true. And that's what we as conservationists have been doing for the last 30 years, predicting things that come true, predicting global warming, predicting superstorms, predicting the oil spills, predicting all the things that the government says aren't possible. A good example, they brought Atlantic salmon to the west coast of Canada, to British Columbia, and the scientists in DFO said, oh, it's okay, they won't escape. Well, of course they escaped. But that's okay, they won't survive. Well, of course they survived. But that's okay. They won't be able to breed. And of course they did. They were wrong consistently. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with these so-called experts all the time. And getting back to intelligence, just to illustrate that, why we are not as intelligent as we think, if anybody's taken Biology 101 or even high school biology, you'll get these little illustrations where they'll show you, here's a rat brain. And next to that, they'll place a dog brain. Then they'll place a chimp brain. Then they'll place a human brain. And they'll say, you can see that the brains get progressively larger, and that the convolutions on the neocortex of each of these species becomes more pronounced, more brain area. Large brains, more convolutions. Therefore, we're more intelligent than those other three. But they never, ever stick a orca or sperm whale brain up there. Makes us look stupid. We don't like to look stupid, so they're just ignored. The human brain has a capacity of 1,300 cubic centimeters. The orca, 6,000. The sperm whale, the largest brain to have ever evolved on the planet, 9,000. 9,000 cubic centimeters. And not only that, all mammals from mice to men have three lobes to the brain, the exception, cetaceans. Dolphins and whales, four lobes. The most highly evolved and sophisticated and complex brain ever evolved, and yet we have the audacity with our little brains to say that they are not intelligent. Well, you know, they don't watch TV driving cars or shoot each other on the freeway. Because they're non-manipulative intelligences, as elephants are, which also have bigger brains than us. Non-manipulative intelligences. And what that means is that they don't need to live in houses, drive cars, or watch television. They're perfectly evolved for the environment that they live in. I was debating a NASA scientist one time. He said, well, the proof that they're not intelligent is they won't be able to explore space. And I said, well, why is that something to aspire to? Why would they want to explore space? We don't even know why we're doing it. We forget that T.S. Eliot, in one of his poems, he said, man shall not cease from exploration, and the end result of all of his searching, he'll be where he began in the first place, but this time he'll know where he is. They know where they are. We're still trying to find out where we are, and that's why we do all of this searching around the universe. I mean, it's okay to study the universe, but, you know, God, We don't want to go, I mean, we've caused enough problems on this planet, you know? Leave the extraterrestrials alone.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio, your voice in Vancouver.
The other problem is the media, the matrix. Why do I call it the matrix? Because it tells you what to think. It tells you what to wear. It tells you how to behave. Television, newspapers, motion pictures dictate every facet of your life, and we just swallow it up and go with it. Our values are dictated by the media. A few years ago, I was a consultant for the Turner Broadcasting Corporation program called Captain Planet. I don't know if anybody remembers Captain Planet and the Planeteers. Cartoon series where Captain Planet was saving the planet. And I was a consultant giving advice until, well, I was a consultant who didn't give any advice, but the day I gave advice, I was no longer a consultant. And that's because Barbara Pyle, the producer, showed Captain Planet to 500 school children at an environmental film festival in Santa Monica, California, and at the end she asked if there were any questions. And she happened to pick the segment of Captain Planet where he was going out into the high seas and destroying drift netters to save whales and dolphins and fish, which is something we were involved in. And I said, Barbara, you got Captain Planet and the Planeteers taking the law into their own hands, and they're going out onto the high seas and destroying property to save life. And I don't have any problem with that, but you're telling all these children it's perfectly all right to take the law into their own hands and go out onto the high seas to destroy property to save life, and I don't have any problem with that either. But what I do have a problem is how come when we grow up and we, as adults, we do what Captain Planet does, your network calls us eco-terrorists. Why are you telling these children that the solution is to be found in a fantasy that you would never endorse in reality? So that illustrates the hypocrisy of these networks. You know, you can, if Tarzan or Captain Planet can protect wildlife, killing people, and yet they're heroes. We don't hurt anybody. You know, the environmental movement is the best example, the conservation movement is the best example of nonviolence of any movement in the history of the world. Not one person has ever been injured or killed by an environmentalist or a conservationist. Not one, nowhere. And yet, what do they call us? Militants and eco-terrorists. And they also call us pirates, but I don't have any problem with that. I like that. The reason being, we actually got our own pirate flag in response to that accusation. The reason being is that, let's go back to the 1600s when piracy was running rampant in the Caribbean. Who was doing anything about it? Nobody. The British Navy and the Spanish Navy weren't doing anything. They were all on the take. The politicians were all on the take. They were no different than politicians today. They had their hands out and they were getting paid by the pirates to operate. Captain Nelson, later to become the great Admiral Nelson, he sailed into Jamaica with the objective of shutting down piracy, couldn't get his ship out of port for 4 months because of lawsuits brought against him by the merchants of Jamaica who didn't want him to interfere with their profits from piracy. So who shut down piracy in the Caribbean? Henry Morgan, a pirate. If you want to stop piracy, you need pirates to do it. Don't depend upon the government to do it. And Henry Morgan, he didn't really become a pirate until he became governor of Jamaica. Then he became a real pirate. But that's what we are. We look on ourselves as good pirates in pursuit of pirates of profits. And we've been working around the world to pursue these pirates and put them out of business. And we've been rather successful. We have sunk 9 whaling ships. We have shut down dozens and dozens of illegal whaling operations. We have saved millions of fish because we have confiscated hundreds and hundreds of miles of illegal long lines and drift nets. We've intercepted and intervened and arrested, you know, dozens and dozens of poaching vessels. And we're doing this all the time in all the world's oceans. And we get away with it. The reason we get away with it, we're simply upholding the law. The perception is that we're criminals. Perception is that we're criminals. The fact is that after we sank half the Icelandic whaling fleet in 1986 and destroyed their whale processing plant in Reykjavik and cost them $10 million in damages, we were accused of being eco-saboteurs, eco-terrorists, and criminals and everything else. A lot of name-calling. So for a year, I couldn't get a response from the Icelandic government. Are there charges against us? They wouldn't even answer me. I had to get on a plane and fly to Reykjavik. I was met at the airport by 150 police officers and the chief immigration officer. And the chief immigration officer said, how long do you intend to stay in our country? I said, I don't know. 5 days, 5 minutes, 5 years. You tell me. We went into interrogation. They sat me down, brought in the Canadian ambassador. Everybody was very serious. Are you admitting to sinking these ships? Yeah, we sank them, and we're going to sink the other two at the first opportunity. The next day, they escorted me to the airport, put me on a plane, and sent me off to New York City. I said, well, what's this all about? Well, what happened was is that the Minister of Justice stood up in Parliament that day, and he said, who the hell does he think he is? He comes into our country and tells us to arrest him. Get him out of here. The reason being is they knew that to put me on trial would be to put themselves on trial for illegal whaling. And they weren't about to get that kind of embarrassment. I was arrested in the Netherlands in 97. First, I was arrested in Germany, but the Germans held me for a few hours and said, well, this is ridiculous, and let me go, because the Norwegians have put out an Interpol warrant for me for sinking a whaling boat. And then I got to Norway, and they arrested me, but the Netherlands. But the Dutch happened to be a little more bureaucratic than the Germans, so I was held over for an extradition trial, which took 120 days while I was in jail waiting for it. But I'll tell you, if you're ever going to go to prison, Holland's the place. I mean, I haven't had rooms like that in five-star hotels, you know. But what I was able to do is wage a campaign from the prison cell. I had a whole page in the equivalent of Time magazine in the Netherlands saying Holland's only political prisoner. Had demonstrations. They allowed the film crews to come into the prison and interview me. The warden even served them coffee and cookies. And that, so we waged an entire anti-whaling campaign from a prison cell, and the Norwegians were so embarrassed by the whole thing, they just dropped the whole ball on it. And because also the Dutch refused to extradite me, which was also very embarrassing for them. So we don't do things and then run and scurry away and hide. What we do is we do our campaigns, our activities, and then we turn ourselves over and say, hey, we did it. What are you going to do about it? And in every single case, we beat them in the courts. In fact, with DFO, they arrested me so many times that back in 84, I was able to turn around and countersue them, and they had to give me a check for $50,000 for damages. Now it's gotten to the point where we're actually working in partnership with governments. I've been invited to, next month, I go to Colombia to sign in a contract with the Minister of National Parks for Colombia to assist in the protection of Malpelo Island Marine Reserve off the coast of Colombia. We've provided the rangers off of Coast Island with everything from their generators to their uniforms to their rifles. We have just finished a 5-year contract with the Galapagos National Park of Ecuador, and we're about to renew that contract to intervene against poaching vessels. Earlier this year, I met with the president of Senegal, and that was an interesting conversation. He had read an article about us in Perry Match, invited my wife and I there. We went to the palace, and he said, we've got to do something about illegal fishing, foreign fishing that's off our coast. And I said, well, what happens when you arrest them now? He says, it's a $200 fine. I said, $200 fine? I mean, if you fine them $200,000, it'd be part of doing business. I said, you have to confiscate their boats. And the Minister of Fisheries interrupted. He says, well, we have no law. We can't confiscate the boats. There's no law that allows us to do it. And the president looked at the minister and said, well, then make one. And now, just 2 days ago, we were invited by Mozambique to try and assist them, too. So these countries are coming to non-government organizations for assistance. And what we're trying to do is raise the funds to get them patrol boats and the equipment they need to get the job done. Because as fish populations are being diminished, the poachers are now moving into national parks and marine reserves. At the end of this year, we will be heading down to the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary. That's our big campaign for this year. We're putting a lot of effort into it. We'll be leaving Melbourne, Australia, on our ship, the Farley Mowat, on December 28th. And our objective is to intercept the Japanese whaling fleet. They are targeting endangered humpbacks and fin whales in the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary in violation of the World Global Moratorium on Commercial Whaling. Blatant violations of international law. And nobody's doing anything about it. The United States could stop all whaling tomorrow by simply enforcing their own laws. And forget about international law. U.S. Department of Commerce regulate. Excuse me. Just sore throat here, but U.S. Department of Commerce regulations state that any country that does not abide by international whaling protection agreements will lose their rights to fish in U.S. waters or sell fish products in the United States. That is the law. Every president from Ronald Reagan, including Clinton and Bush, have refused to enforce the law for fear of having trade problems with Japan. And we find this over and over again. Trade relations take precedence over the law. And this is one of the major problems facing the world. Captain Cousteau said just before he died, he said that the oceans are dying in our time, and if the world's navies had any sense of moral responsibility, they would be out there defending the oceans instead of playing their stupid, silly little war games with each other. You know, we have the means to enforce, we have the ships, we have the people, we have the laws. We just don't have the political will to do it. But, you know, the impossible can become the possible, and that's what gives me a lot of faith. I was in South Africa in 1972. I wrote an article when I came back about a man who was in prison, and I couldn't get that article published in any newspaper in North America, established newspaper. I finally got it published in the Georgia Strait in Vancouver. But the article was about Nelson Mandela, who the newspaper said, we're not interested in an article on terrorists. You know, the man's a terrorist. We're not going to give him a time of day. Who would have thought in 1972, who could have even imagined that Nelson Mandela would be president of South Africa? It was unthinkable. It was unimaginable. And yet it happened. The impossible became possible. Because the strength of any movement lies in the force of individuals' passions and compassion and their energies. It's individuals that stand up and fight that make the difference. Because of Diane Fossey, the mountain gorillas of Rwanda have survived. Because of Baruti Geldikas, orangutans have been protected in Borneo. I could go through a whole litany of people who have made that kind of difference. David Wingate, who saved the storm petrel in Bermuda. On and on and on. People who have devoted their life to protecting a species or an ecosystem. What greater legacy can one leave than the fact that one lived, and because one lived, a species was saved or an ecosystem was protected? Journalists all the time say, how can you risk your life to protect a whale? And how can you risk other people's lives to protect whales? I said, well, that's a real stupid question. You know, I mean, you don't ask that of those soldiers over there in Iraq who are fighting over oil wells or real estate, other people's real estate. You know, we think that that's real noble crap, you know. Pin a medal on somebody for killing somebody to protect an oil well, but geez, they all get bent out of shape when you try to protect a whale. A ranger in Zimbabwe a few years ago shot and killed a poacher who was about to kill a black rhinoceros, and human rights groups around the world just went ballistic on that. How dare you kill a human being to protect an animal? And his answer in Time magazine, I thought, really illustrated the hypocrisy of humankind. He said, you know, if I was a police officer in Harare, and a man ran out of Barclays Bank with a bag of money, and I shot him in the head and killed him, you'd pin a medal on me and call me a hero. How is it that a bag of paper is not worth as much, is worth more than the future heritage of the nation of Zimbabwe? It's just blatant hypocrisy, and the media perpetuates that hypocrisy.
You've got Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM from Vancouver, Canada.
One of the things that we have to understand when working within the context of the media culture is how to work with the media, and that is how to manipulate the media. You have to be able to manipulate them, and don't, when people say, oh my God, he wants to manipulate the media. Well, politicians do it, Coca-Cola does it, why can't we? It's easier for them, they just simply buy the media. But there's four elements of media, four things that media cannot resist. And if you can utilize those elements in your issue, you got yourself a story. And those four elements are simply sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. Every story has to have one of those elements. If you got all four elements, you got one of those stories that never seems to go away. You see those all the time. And an example of that is 1984, a local example. In 1984, I led a campaign against aerial killing of wolves in British Columbia. And it was the perfect story, and it carried the headlines across Canada for 2 weeks. The reason being is that we had the violence of them shooting wolves from helicopters and the threats by the people up there to shoot us if we came up to try and protect the wolves. So we had that down pretty good. Then we had the Minister of the Environment, who took a bribe from a big game hunting organization. That was Tony Brummett, the Minister of Environment in British Columbia. We had scandal there. Violence and scandal. Got two of the elements. We need the other two. So I recruited Bo Derek as our spokesperson. At the press conference, a reporter said, "What's Bo Derek know about wolves? This is stupid." I said, "Well, you must have just graduated from journalism school." So if I had the best wolf scientist, Dr. Gordon Haber or David Meck here, be an empty room. No story. But because Bo Derek is our spokesperson, this will be the headline story in your newspaper tomorrow. You will write it, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. There's no way he was not going to write that story. That's why we brought Bridget Bardot to the ice floes of Newfoundland in the 70s. Her picture posed cheek to cheek with a baby seal guaranteed us the cover of the major international magazines. That's just the way it is. That's why our advisory board for the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has a lot of celebrities on it. You know, I say, how can we lose? I mean, I've got Captain Kirk, James Bond, MacGyver, and the President of the United States on my board. President being Martin Sheen, whom some Americans actually think is the president. And to show you how silly it all gets, Richard Dean Anderson was on our crew out in the seal hunt this year. And we had a hull breach, and we were taken in water. But the Newfoundland papers contacted. They wanted to talk to Richard. How come you can't fix it? They asked that question seriously. And Richard's answer was he didn't have his writers with him, so he couldn't do it. But we are so enraptured by media that when this motion picture about me is made, the amazing thing is that Christian Bale, who is now Batman, will be more me than I've ever been me. Motion pictures legitimize what you're doing, so suddenly what was radical becomes acceptable. That's how the media works. The other thing is that in dealing with the media is that we always have to understand that they're not your friend, and so therefore you have to be able to do to manipulate them with imagination, because they're always looking for the way to trip you up. So this is, you know, the ongoing battles with the media. So we have to fight the governments. We have to fight the bureaucracies. We have to fight the pirates out on the high seas. And we have to fight the media. And so it can get pretty tedious at times. But at the same time, there is a great sense of satisfaction with my crew because we're out there in the field and actually making a difference. I can't tell you how wonderful it feels to pull a hook out of a sea turtle's mouth and then release it and watch it swim away. And to bring sharks on board and remove those hooks and then put them back and watch them swim away too. It's just an absolutely amazing feeling that you get. But I just want to explain briefly why it is that I do what I do and why my clients are not of the human variety. And it all goes back to 1975 off the coast of California when I was with Greenpeace. We intercepted the Russian whaling fleet. And we had been reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, and we had come up with this great idea. Just put ourselves between the harpoons and the whales, and those whalers aren't going to kill those whales because why? They're not going to risk a human life now, are they, to kill a whale? Simple. Well, I suddenly found myself in front of a large Russian harpoon vessel, moving through the water at 18 knots, Bob Hunter and I in a little rubber boat in front of it, and very rough seas, and in front of us, eight magnificent sperm whales that were fleeing for their life. Every time that the harpooner tried to get a shot, I would maneuver the boat and block his path. And we were feeling real good about this and stopped them for about 25 minutes, and then the captain of the whaling boat came down the catwalk, screamed into the ear of the harpooner, and then looked at us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat, which suddenly I realized Gandhi wasn't going to work. Suddenly, we descended into a trough, The whales rose up in front of us. The ship rose up behind us. There was a horrendous explosion. A 150-pound harpoon flew over our head and slammed into the backside of one of the whales. A fountain of blood rose in the air. She screamed this human-like scream, and the largest whale in that pond suddenly hit the water with its tail, slapped it, and disappeared beneath the surface. Now, we had been told by all of the experts that that whale would attack us, and we had seen all the pictures of the Yankee whalers, their little boats getting snapped like toothpicks by enraged sperm whales. So I can tell you it was with a great deal of anxiety that we sat in a little rubber boat waiting for 50 tons of very angry whale to come up underneath of us. And as we did, the ocean erupted behind me, and I saw this whale hurl himself straight out of the water at that harpooner. He had targeted that harpooner, and he was going for him. And the harpooner was very ready for him. He knew he would do that. He very nonchalantly pulled the trigger and sent at point-blank range a second exploding harpoon into the head of the whale. It exploded. The whale screamed, fell back into the water, was rolling about on the water, thrashing, blood everywhere. And as he rolled, I caught his eye, and he looked straight at me, and he disappeared beneath the surface. And now I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming straight towards our little boat. And he came up and out of the water at an angle over and above us. The water, the blood pouring down off his head straight onto us like a shower. So close I could have reached up with my hand and encircled one of those 6-inch teeth with my fingers. And I looked up into an eye the size of my fist. And I looked into that eye, and what I saw in that eye changed my life forever, because I saw understanding. The whale understood what we were trying to do, because with a great effort, instead of coming forward and crushing us, the whale suddenly fell backwards, and I saw him slip beneath the surface of the sea. I saw his eye disappear beneath the surface, and he died. That whale could have taken my life. I could have died that day. The whale chose not to kill me. I feel indebted to that whale. And I also saw something in that eye that changed my life, and that was pity. That's what I felt when I looked into that eye. Pity. Not for himself, for us. We could commit such an act of blasphemy. Why were we killing those whales? The Russians were killing the whales for high heat-resistant oil for lubricating machinery. And one of the pieces of machinery that it was destined for was intercontinental ballistic missiles. Whale oil used in intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said to myself on that boat out in the water, just as the sun was going down, I said, we are destroying these magnificent, intelligent creatures for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass destruction of humanity. We're insane. We're absolutely, totally insane. And ever since, I've dedicated myself to protecting their kind and life in the oceans. As for people, they haven't shown that they deserve to be protected yet. After sinking those ships in Iceland, I had a former colleague from Greenpeace come by, and he said, I just want to tell you that what you people did in Iceland was despicable, reprehensible, criminal, and unforgivable. I said, so? He said, well, I think you should know how we feel. I said, John, I don't care how you feel. We didn't sink those ships for you. We didn't sink those ships for you or any of the other 6 billion people on this planet. We sunk them for the whales, John. Find me one whale that disagreed with that action, and I promise you we will never do it again. But until then, we're going to continue to destroy whaling boats to save the lives of whales. I do not want to live on a planet that has destroyed whales. To me, it's self-preservation. It saddens me that not only do we destroy these animals, we forget they even existed. We adapt to their diminishment. The Atlantic gray whale is gone. We just formed an organization, by the way, the Atlantic Gray Whale Society, and the object is to transplant a gray whale population from the Pacific and try and reestablish them in the Atlantic. But the Atlantic gray whale is gone. The eastern bison, gone. The Newfoundland wolf, gone. The Carolina parakeet, gone. The Caspian tiger, gone. I mean, I could sit here for the next 30 minutes and tell you all of the species that we have exterminated just within the last 150 to 200 years. And we've forgotten they've existed. Just completely forgotten that beluga whales once swam in Long Island Sound, that the so-called polar bears, which were called white bears at the time, were found in Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine. We've forgotten that. We've adapted to diminishment. And we do it all the time. Now in the fisheries, we're adapting to diminishment. Only 10 years ago, orange roughy, that fish was found in all of the fish markets. It was in all the restaurants. You don't see it now. We've forgotten that it was ever served. Why? Because we wiped it out. It's gone. Now we're going after Patagonia toothfish, sometimes called Chilean sea bass, wiping it out illegally. We'll forget about it soon, too. turbot, which was considered, I was raised in a fishing village on the East Coast, and turbot was considered, well, it's not very nice to the fish, but it was considered what was called a trash fish. That meant it didn't have any taste and nobody wanted it, so you didn't fish for it. Where do you get turbot today? In the best restaurants in Paris and New York. Why? They wiped out everything else. You get crab salad. It's no longer real crab, but people don't really believe. I mean, they believe that this pollock, which has no taste, with artificial red dye and chemical scent, is crab. And I don't eat this stuff, but when I went into the restaurant, I said, that's not crab salad. Oh, yes, it's crab. I says, no, it isn't. It's pollock with red dye on it and chemical scent. No, this is crab. I said, this is false advertising. And they said, but they believed it was crab. Do you know that most of the fish that's taken out of the ocean, 50% of it isn't eaten by people? We feed it to cows, pigs, sheep, chickens, and other fish. It takes 30 to 50 fish caught from the ocean to raise one of those Atlantic salmon. We're turning herbivores into carnivores, and then we wonder why we have health problems after that. But the fact is that's where most of the fish is. And here's another fact. House cats, your domestic house cat, eat more fish than all of the world's seals put together. So house cats have surpassed seals as a major aquatic carnivore. We have turned house cats into aquatic carnivores. They don't have to go to sea. We make it easy for them. But that's what they in fact are. Our ship promotes vegetarianism and veganism. We're a completely vegetarian vegan ship. And we have been for many years. And we don't insist that people have to be vegans or vegetarians to come on the ship, except that when they come on the ship, they don't find anything else other than that to eat. And, they can go back to whatever when they leave. But while they're on the ship, they do. And it's amazing because we don't really preach it, but people get an opportunity to experience it. And it's amazing how many people adapt to it. People been to any third world countries into a butcher store or one of the markets to sell meat. You get to see meat for what it really is. It's not that red, nice-looking stuff packaged in plastic. It's green and greasy and gray and covered in flies usually when you see it there. There's no such thing. You know, we try to, when people eat meat, humans eat meat, they try to say, oh, we're like lions, we're like tigers, we're like bears and wolves, we're carnivores. No, we're not. We're like vultures and jackals and carrion eaters. People don't eat meat. They eat dead bodies. We're necrivores. That's what we are. In fact, we're even worse because most of the meat that we eat has been dead for weeks, months, and sometimes years. Imagine that when you're eating a steak. The thing's been dead for over a year. But anyway, probably, you know, some people will disagree. But the fact is that in order to raise this meat diet, we have to destroy the oceans, because we're feeding these meat-producing animals, fish and krill, and taking protein out of the oceans to raise cattle, sheep, and chickens. And it's just not natural, and it's going to have repercussions. The oceans are in trouble. They're being diminished at an incredible rate, and will die within the next generation unless we turn it around.
That was Paul Watson speaking on Saving Our Oceans in Edmonton, Alberta. Born in Toronto, Paul Watson was raised in the lobster fishing town of St. Andrews-by-the-Sea in New Brunswick, the eldest of seven children. He was a co-founder of Greenpeace in 1972 and left the organization in 1977 because he felt its original goals were compromised. That same year, he started Sea Shepherds to continue direct action tactics to defend marine wildlife. In 2000, Watson was chosen by Time magazine as one of the environmental heroes of the 20th century. He is author of Shepherds of the Sea, Sea Shepherd, My Fight for Whales and Seals, Earth Force, Ocean Warrior, and Seal Wars, most recently in 2002. This has been Canadian Voices, a nationally syndicated public affairs radio series and podcast produced by Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. This talk was recorded by CJSR FM 88 in Edmonton, Alberta in September 2005. We would like to thank the project supporters for their volunteer and financial assistance and the campus and community radio stations across Canada for airing the series. For more information and resources on the content of this lecture, as well as an archive of all Canadian Voices programs, please visit our website at canadianvoices.org. The site also contains information on ordering the series, podcasting, and how you can financially contribute to the project's ongoing success. Theme music is an arrangement by Blox recording artist Final Fantasy, reinterpreted by the Nelson BC duo Overlap. Canadian Voices has been coordinated by Zoe Creighton, with input from volunteers across the country. Thanks for listening.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, co-op radio from Vancouver, Canada, listener-supported radio.